on Sunday night on ABC Radio. In just a moment, Noel will slip into the chair and introduce us to The Good Life for Lent.
You're listening to The Good Life with me, Noel Debien, on ABC Radio, online or through your pod. And it's Lent, the 40 days of preparation before Easter for Christians, and we're about to embark on some Christian self-discipline on The Good Life. We're going straight to the top to get the good oil on Lent, the bottom line, and who better than a Roman Catholic Archbishop? Mark Coleridge is the Catholic Archbishop of Canberra-Goulburn, and he's been good enough to join me to speak about the Christian version of Ramadan, the time of self-denial and self-discipline, Lent. Lent itself, the English word, it's an old English word that really comes from a root that means to lengthen. It means the lengthening of days or spring. So it seems to have even a pre-Christian origin.
Well, Easter has a pre-Christian origin too, so there's nothing very surprising about that. Christianity took over all kinds of nature festivals and rites of passage through the year and simply baptised them. And Easter is certainly one of those. It was originally a fertility festival. And the preparation for that time is the lengthening of days and looking to the great fertility festival of Easter. But it also, it relates to the French word lent, which means slow. And there's there's that sense in Christianity of the days of Lent being days of slowing down in order to focus. It's a bit like a slow motion replay in sport. You slow it down in order to focus upon the detail, and Lent is a time of slowing down in the midst of a frenetic life in order to focus on what matters.
What's the bottom line now for Catholics when it comes down to, you know, the non-negotiable rules around Lent?
Well, in fact, the rules aren't nearly what they used to be, and sometimes I think we've grown a bit slack on all this. We should be perhaps a little more demanding. But in fact, there are only 2 days of what are called fast and abstinence. The first of them we've just had, Ash Wednesday, and the second of them, Good Friday. When I say fast and abstinence, this applies to people who are obviously not sick and not the elderly and the very young. But we're expected to not only cut down on the volume of stuff we eat on those 2 days, but also to refrain from eating meat. That's what it means when I say abstinence. But then everyone is expected on other days of the 40 days of Lent to undertake some special kind of penance or act of self-restraint, self-renunciation. In other words, to say no to certain things, but in order to say yes to the bigger things upon which we focus in these days.
You would remember Lent and the practices of Lent, I think, from your childhood when they were stricter, wouldn't you?
They certainly were. I mean, I'm 60, so I can remember way back into the 50s, the good old days. They were severe, comparatively severe at least, when I think of now. What's happened in the meantime, I think, is that people have been left to make their own decision rather than the church, as it were, dictating to them and saying, you must do this, you must not do that. The trouble is when you leave it up to people, I don't want this to sound sort of patronising, but it probably will, but if you leave it up to people, the danger is that they forget, and we're all great at making excuses for ourselves and getting ourselves off the hook. In some ways, a bit of external discipline can be a help, I think. At the same time, I wouldn't underestimate the kind of decisions that people take during these days. I mean, people do, in fact, give up all kinds of things. And also, see, traditionally, the three great Christian acts through Lent are prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. And they go back way, way deep into the Bible. And I wouldn't doubt for a moment that these days are times of special prayer. I certainly know that they are times of extraordinary generosity when it comes to almsgiving. You've only got to look at the millions of dollars that people give to a thing like Project Compassion.
Now, Project Compassion that you just mentioned, that for those who are not familiar with the Catholic Church and what it does, that's the little boxes that go out on Ash Wednesday, yeah?
Well, they're big boxes, actually. They're bigger than they used to be.
For putting money in.
That's right. And lots of folding money, we hope. We don't like heavy coins.
Silent offerings appreciated.
Exactly, yes. But I forget how many million they raise each year, but it is an extraordinary act of generosity. So on that front, I think we as Catholics do very well. And I think, too, the business of prayer is something that people do get into through these days of Lent with a special intensity and depth. But fasting, as I say, may well be something that we kind of let slip a bit or just look the other way. Because it's tough. I mean, in this culture, as I say, where we're used to overconsumption, serious fasting is something that is difficult. There's no question, because it's swimming against the tide, big time.
I wonder, just recently I'd been looking, not so long ago actually, at Ramadan and the practices of Ramadan.
Yep.
And of course, a lot of Australian Muslims, from sunrise, from just before sunrise to sunset, no water, no food of any sort passes their lips. And a lot of these people actually work with me here at the ABC. And that's quite a tough thing. And then you think, well, where's the Catholic Church gotten to if being outdone by Muslims?
I don't know about being outdone, but the other thing about Ramadan you've got to keep in mind is once the sun goes down, out comes the picnic. I'll never forget being in Dubai Airport in the middle of the night, and there were people everywhere sitting on the floor during Ramadan having what looked to be the best picnic of all time. So in Islam, the tendency is, as you say, to fast from sunrise to sunset and then to go for it. But Christianity, you're expected both day and night to indulge in a kind of self-restraint, which most religions, not just Christianity, but any religion that I know talks about self-restraint as being a fundamental element of the good life.
People who've seen The Da Vinci Code, they've got some fairly, from my reading the book, fairly inaccurate ideas about what a group like Opus Dei is, for example.
Sure.
But one thing that I did notice when studying The Way, which is Escriva's book,
yep,
he does talk a lot about bodily mortification.
Yeah.
Now, that's not so common among broader Christians, but it is practiced within Opus Dei, isn't it?
Not just Opus Dei. It's a profound stream within the history of Christianity. You've only got to go back to a spiritual athlete of epic proportion like Antony of Egypt to see the way in which the disciplining of the body was radically tied to the liberation of the soul. So what you see in Opus Dei is not something that the founder of Opus Dei suddenly thought of. It represents a retrieval in more or less recent times of a very deep and ancient stream within Christianity. And basically what it's saying is that this world is not all we have. The body is not all we are. And that if we think the body is all we are, and if we think this world is all we have, then what take over are what the Bible calls the false gods. So that this kind of bodily mortification, a training of the flesh to serve the liberation of the spirit, is something that is essentially positive, even though it can seem world-denying and life-denying. But in fact, it's an affirmation of the body in a Christian sense, but just saying that here we have no permanent home and that we are much more than the body. The body must be made to serve the liberation of the human spirit.
And it is a fine line, though, in a way, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you can end up in a sort of a Manichaean heresy.
Absolutely.
Where the body's bad. And
that's right. But that's the exact opposite of Christianity. And every heresy that Christianity has ever known has spoken about the body as bad and the material world as evil. But if Christianity says, as it does, that the Word was made flesh, in other words, God is to be found always and only in the flesh is good.
Impossible to separate as we're alive.
Well, that's what the Manichaean world separates, body and soul, and that's absolutely not what Christianity does. In fact, it's the exact opposite.
So in that sense, abstinence from meat or fasting or various forms of penance, I mean, people who saw movies like The Old Nun Story, you know, which Deborah Carr was starring in, even in there they used that sort of ritual whipping action, which wasn't meant to hurt them, but to remind them that, you know, there was pain on Calvary, as it were.
It's ritual, exactly. It's ritual gesture. I mean, again, Christianity says, you know, once you start whipping yourself to the point of drawing blood, stop, wrong way, go back. But what it is a ritual gesture that is a reminder of the need to discipline or mortify the flesh, lest the flesh take over and dominate us in a way that puts us on a depressing treadmill that leads nowhere.
Is fasting a practice that has ever entered your own personal practice and spirituality?
Yeah, it has. I mean, I wish I were more rigorous in the pursuit of it. But it has, and certainly it does in Lent. But again, I mean, not in any dramatic way. I suppose I've lived in too many affluent countries like Australia and Italy to have it forced upon me. As I've grown older, in fact, I think I've come to appreciate more and more, not only the value, but probably even the necessity of a kind of fasting from food and from drink. But there are many other renunciations, because any life, certainly the Christian life, and certainly my life as a priest and a bishop, involves great renunciations. I mean, I think, for example, in my own life of the renunciation of celibacy. Now, to live that renunciation creatively, you've got to make a lot of very small renunciations through the years. In other words, the great renunciations are built upon a foundation of many small renunciations. Mm. The word that Christians use traditionally is asceticism. If there is not a genuine asceticism in the life of certainly a bishop and a priest, but I think in the life of any Christian, then the danger is we're sort of bending the knee to the spirit of the world. We've got to be in the world, but not of it. If we never learn the art of renunciation, we will be both in the world and of it. But for the Christian, we have got to be very much in the world, immersed in it, but not of it, in the sense imprisoned in it.
And these forms of abstinence and self-discipline, as I understand it, they can be good in themselves, in that it's limiting one's, I suppose, passions or concupiscence, I think, is the technical word
that is used. In other words, desire that's got out of control.
So yeah. It can be good in its sense that you're disciplining your own wants all the time, you know, giving them a break. But on the other hand, I can remember when I went to an Augustinian school many years ago, just before play lunch, you know, the Augustinian friar would bring out that Project Compassion box in Lent and rattle it round and say, now, instead of that cream bun at morning tea, boys, and in the money went.
Yeah, well, that's not bad education, I think. Because, well, we all like cream buns, or we did back then. But to say to kids, don't spend the money on your cream bun, put it in the box, I think that's not bad education.
Well, indeed, that's the way it was put to us, that instead of having something extra that we would like, therefore the money went elsewhere to where it was needed in Project Compassion, which would be overseas in mission, and it would be for the work of the church. And so that sort of denial of self plus giving to others goes together, doesn't it?
But all of that is part of a larger process in Christianity of the education of desire. I mean, St. Augustine says we are what we desire, but desire can attach itself to all kinds of false gods. What Christians say is that all human desire in the end is a desire for God. But if desire doesn't find its way to God, then it will turn dark and destructive. So all of these acts of self-giving, of renunciation, of mortification, if you like, are all about the education of desire. In other words, leading desire home, and by home I mean leading human desire to God. That's what I mean by focusing upon what really matters, and in the end focusing upon God.
Dear, that sounds so unfashionable when you say
it. It is unfashionable, and it's not easy. I mean, I say this personally. Each Lent I make the great sacrifice of giving up wine. I don't give up alcohol, note, but I do give up wine. Now, that might be easy for some, but as one who's lived for many years in Italy, and where the first thing that goes on the dinner table is a bottle of wine just about, it is a considerable sacrifice. Mind you, I do exempt myself on Sundays, which are not days of Lent. So I do have a glass of wine on Sundays. But even a thing like that, which can seem trivial, is something that I find a genuine discipline.
Indeed. I'm surprised by the number of people I know who actually give up alcohol entirely for Lent.
Yeah, well, that's a big call. I keep to a glass of wine on Sunday and then a nightcap at the end of the day to recover from the rigours of all that's gone before. But no, it is, and this is a drinking society. I'm not saying necessarily that we drink too much, but it is a society that drinks, and where alcohol is simply part of the culture, and often a very pleasant and a very good part of the culture. But But anyway, I find it a real sacrifice. But at the same time, it's also good physically. I lose weight every Lent, which is a good thing when you're my age and size. So what is good for the body is also good for the soul. I mean, with a prayer that I prayed this morning said, "Oh God, you ask us to undertake bodily discipline for the good of the soul." And that fundamental interaction between body and soul, again, is central to the Christian practice of fasting.
Well, you being a priest and bishop, of course, you would be a daily Mass attender minimum.
I am.
There are many other Catholics who would also go to Mass more frequently, for example, during Lent, I presume.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, the numbers at daily Mass tend to swell. And that's one of the ways, I say, that Catholics give themselves more intensely and more deeply to prayer. It's not the only way, of course, but it's certainly noticeable that you find more people coming to daily Mass.
Now, I noticed also before you gave a little bit of wriggle room, and I always like wriggle room when it comes to major world religions.
Very Catholic policy.
Sundays are not days
Sundays are not days of Lent. No, Sunday is always an Easter day. So on Sunday, you anticipate the Easter that's coming. It's the sort of fertility festival before you have it. So Sundays are not days of Lent, even though we talk about the first Sunday of Lent, the second Sunday of Lent. Sunday is always, it's the weekly Easter. But, I mean, once Sunday's over, it's back to no wine on the table.
So strictly speaking, though, Archbishop, now I'm just looking for further wriggle room here. Yep. After first Vespers of Sunday on Saturday night, it's already Sunday, isn't it?
That's right, and that's why I had a glass of wine dinner on
So you can have a glass of wine.
You know too much for your own good. Only after first Vespers, but once you've said second Vespers on Sunday evening, that's it.
So you can't have it after Vespers on Sunday
no,
evening?
No, that's far
There's
too much.
There's just a 24-hour period.
Just a 24-hour period.
Good news for all those Catholics out there.
Wriggle room, but not too much.
Now, so that means if we're counting Lent, you count Ash Wednesday, then Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then you count not the Sunday but the next 6 days, not the Sunday but the next, so on and so forth, and you get exactly 40 days when you get to Holy Saturday.
That's about right, yeah. Maths was never my best subject, but you're more or less right, I think.
I promise.
And
I
the 40 days of Lent looks back to the 40 days of Jesus in the desert. I mean, this is, again, for Christians, our 40 days of fasting and prayer are really celebrating the 40 days that Jesus spent in the Judean wilderness, we're told. He went out there driven by the Holy Spirit and confronted the power of evil. And
this is his preparation for ministry.
That's right, exactly. And so it was a time of kind of spiritual training. And that's what Lent is like. It's a kind of a spiritual exercise that's supposed to train us for the spiritual warfare that lies ahead.
And so that 40 days is seen really as a preparation time for the actual core of what Christians do, which is the most important festival of the year, which is the Easter festival.
Easter's everything. I mean, as St. Paul says it, if Jesus Christ is not risen from the dead, then we're the most pathetic people of all. There are plenty of people who think he isn't risen from the dead, but the Christians tend to disagree. So in other words, the renunciation, the self-restraint of Lent is all about preparing for the great feast of Easter. But if the preparation is seriously hard work, then the festival tends to be a wow. The feast is great.
Archbishop Mark Coleridge, thank you very much for being part of The Good Life.
Thank you.